May it please the court. My name is Gary Apple, registration number 8883. I represent the interveners, the appellants in this case, Celeste Reinberg, CCG LLC, Pre-Caspian Development Corporation, and Cadeco LLC. The factual and procedural background in this case, I think, is pretty straightforward. I presume that the court, that each of the judges has read the briefs and understands that. I won't go into it unless you have questions about the background procedural issues that arose. The bottom line is that the trial court in this case decided that it had jurisdiction to adjudicate claims against the interveners. And the first issue, which is the one I would like to focus my attention on, the first issue in the briefs, is whether or not the trial court has jurisdiction in a garnishment proceeding over the alter ego and Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act claims against parties other than the garnishee. And that's the key in this proceeding that I think the trial court failed to appreciate. To determine the court's jurisdiction in a garnishment proceeding, I think the first thing that we have to do is to look at the statute that creates that jurisdiction. As we cited in our brief, both briefs actually, the courts in Colorado have always said that garnishment is a creature of statute and it needs to be confined to its statutory underpinnings. So if we look at the statute that creates the remedy, which is in this case 1354.5, 103.2, it provides in relevant part that a debt owed to the judgment debtor by the garnishee can be garnished. So that's the issue that we're trying to get at the garnishment proceeding. Garnishment Rule 103, which does not create jurisdiction, obviously pursuant to statute, the rule simply implements garnishment procedures. But it echoes the same thing that the statute says. What we're trying to deal with in the garnishment proceeding is a debt owed by the garnishee, in this case the banks, to the judgment debtor. And so the rule says, in relevant part in Section 3, upon hearing the traverse, and in this case there was a traverse of the five writs of garnishment, if the court finds that the garnishee is liable, the garnishee is liable to the judgment debtor, then the court shall enter judgment in favor of judgment debtor for the use and benefit of the creditor.
Counsel, in this case, we have more than just the garnishee and the folks holding the judgment. We also have an intervention. Why shouldn't we conclude that intervention effectively gave the trial court jurisdiction to decide issues, especially when the intervener's status as potential owners of the assets was at issue, and when they had a full opportunity to participate in a four-day hearing on those very issues?
Yeah, Judge Fox, is certainly a good question. There are two answers to that question. The first is that the intervention was for the purpose of challenging the court's subject matter jurisdiction. And the trial court expressly so found it in its order of June 8, 2012. The trial court says all five, referring to the interveners, have intervened to contest whether a traverse of garnishment proceedings under the rule and the statute is the proper means for resolution of the dispute. So the trial court acknowledged that the purpose of the intervention was to challenge the court's subject matter jurisdiction. And there are no cases that I'm aware of that say that an intervention to challenge subject matter jurisdiction is a submission to the court subject matter jurisdiction.
Counsel.
Indeed, I don't think that you can confer jurisdiction on a court by intervening in that circumstance. Yes,
Counsel, I've read the motion to intervene. It doesn't say a thing about intervening to challenge subject matter jurisdiction.
It says
you wish to contest and claim ownership of the funds.
I don't recall, you have it in front of you, I don't
yes.
recall that it says we wish to contest ownership. What it says, I believe, is that the funds are the funds of the interveners and not the judgment debtor, and that's really exactly the point. There was nothing in this case that involved a contest over who owned those funds. The funds, it was always conceded, were owned by the interveners. And that's why this case is distinguished from the Great Neck Plaza case as well. In the Great Neck Plaza case, what happened is the garnishing creditor claimed that the funds were owned by the judgment debtor. And if that were, and that's the issue that the court decided in Great Neck Plaza. And if that were true, which the court determined it was, then the bank owed a debt to the judgment debtor. That's within the jurisdiction, of course, of the court in a garnishment proceeding.
That's exactly what happened here. No. I mean, the contention was, let me finish, counsel. The contention was expressly that the funds claimed to be owned by the interveners were in fact owned by the judgment debtors because the interveners were mere alter egos or fraudulent transferees of the judgment debtors.
Your Honor, let me address that in two respects. First, the only party that was alleged to be an intervener was CCG LLC. The other parties were never asserted to be alter egos of the judgment debtor. That's first. Secondly, it was never asserted by the judgment creditor in this case that the funds in the accounts were really the judgment debtors. What was asserted is that the funds should be applied to the judgment. And to the contrary, Your Honor, the trial court expressly found, and we cited the page and the quotation in our brief, the trial court expressly found that the accounts were the accounts of the interveners. There was no factual finding anywhere in the 36 pages that the trial court entered that were written by the judgment creditor that the funds in the accounts were funds of the judgment debtor. That would have been a completely different case. That isn't what happened here.
I'm not convinced. I mean, the court found that the interveners were alter egos or fraudulent transferees and that the funds belonged to the judgment debtors.
No. That was never, at least I don't see that anywhere in the court's findings, that the funds are the funds of the judgment debtor. That's our fundamental, if we're going to disagree, that's our fundamental disagreement. And I think that you need to very carefully search the findings of the trial court. I don't see anything in the findings that says the funds are the funds of the judgment debtor. The trial court never made that finding. At least not that I saw.
But doesn't it logically follow that if you allow the holders of the judgment access to those funds, the court is implicitly, if not otherwise, concluding that you know the funds originated with Mr. Greinberg and then were transferred by fraudulent conveyance or by an alter ego theory to these other entities?
No, Judge Fox, it doesn't. What that does is put the cart before the horse. It essentially bootstraps into jurisdiction because it says, well, if you decide that, then what you're saying essentially is, well, let's let trial courts decide these issues, and then if they decide in favor of the judgment creditor, then we'll find that there's jurisdiction. That, I suggest to you, really is completely the wrong approach. The correct approach is, does the court have subject matter jurisdiction to decide this issue under the statute? And by asking the question you asked with respect, I think that you're really mixing up the conclusion and allowing the conclusion to justify the jurisdictional prerequisite. I don't think we can do that. I think we first have to ask ourselves, is there jurisdiction under the statute? And again, the question under the statute is, does the garnishee owe a debt to the judgment debtor? And again, Judge Jones, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, and I apologize to you, but I don't see anything in the order, the findings and conclusions, where the trial court judge made a determination that the funds in the accounts were funds of the judgment debtor. What the trial court decided was CCG LLC is an alter ego of the judgment debtor and therefore liable for the debt. And secondly, that there were fraudulent transfers from the judgment debtor. There are many circumstances where creditors have claims against parties other than the judgment debtor. But all of those circumstances cannot be asserted in garnishment proceedings. Garnishment proceedings are very, very narrowly defined by statute. to a specific determination about whether there's a debt from the garnishee to the judgment debtor. If so, then that debt is obviously applied to satisfy the judgment. In other circumstances, the creditors assert claims against judgment against third parties, but they can't do it in a garnishment proceeding. For example, if a creditor believes that the judgment debtor has fraudulently transferred property, which is one of the claims that was asserted here, under the Colorado Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, FUFTA, those claims are asserted in a forum in which the judgment creditor sues the fraudulent transferee, serves them with process, and then those claims are determined in that context. What happened here is the judgment creditor said, well, let's bypass that whole thing and let's instead just garnish the bank accounts of the third parties, and that'll give the court jurisdiction to decide these issues. That fundamentally is what I think was wrong here.
But
jurisdiction
counsel,
was acquired purportedly by garnishing the bank account.
You use the term third parties, but that begs the question. I mean, didn't the court essentially determine that, at least as to one of the entities here, there wasn't really a third party? There is an alter ego.
I understand.
When there's an alter ego, that entity is one and the same as the judgment debtor.
I understand why Your Honor says that, but I do not believe that's a correct statement of law. I think if you look at the alter ego cases from both this court and the Supreme Court, the court does not say that a finding of alter ego means they're one in the same. That's not the conclusion. The conclusion is if there is a finding of alter ego, then the alter ego is liable for the debts of the other party. It doesn't mean they're the same thing.
It says that the corporate difference is disregarded. If it's disregarded, how can they not be one and the same?
There is no decision that I'm aware of that I can think of, Judge Jones, where the court has adopted that view, where either this court or the Supreme Court has adopted that view and said they're one and the same. That would have many ramifications far beyond an alter ego finding. The alter ego finding just makes the other party liable for that debt. That's it. It doesn't mean that for all purposes they then are disregarded.
All of the cases talk about whether there is, as a matter of law, a difference between the two entities. And it says, no, if they're alter egos, there is no difference. They are the same.
Your Honor, with respect, I do not read the cases that way. I think if you go back and look at them carefully, they don't use those words, and that isn't really the concept that underlies what those cases are talking about. What they're saying is, should the entity veil be disregarded so that entity becomes liable, so its assets are applied to repayment of the debt of the other party? That's the underlying issue. If I could, I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
You may. You have just a little bit over a minute.
May it please the court. My name is Christina Gomez, bar number 36026. I represent Lowe Partners Corporation, acting as agent, for the participants in LNR Exploration Venture. It is unfortunate, though not surprising, that we are here in this court for the second time in this case. Now, 12 years after this litigation started and nearly 5 years after Loeb obtained and domesticated a judgment of $1.6 million against Jack Greinberg, now through his alter egos and fraudulent transferees, still seeks to prolong this dispute and prevent Loeb from collecting on the judgment. Again, his arguments are meritless. I'm prepared today to discuss any of these arguments, but in particular, we'll focus on the one that counsel has been arguing here. And that is that Loeb properly applied Rule 103 to reach Greinberg's assets in the possession of the garnishee banks. Loeb proved that those bank funds were Greinberg's through application of the alter ego and fraudulent transfer theories, just as the judgment creditor did in Great Neck. There was no reason for Loeb to have to file an entirely new proceeding and to suffer even greater delays to collect on the judgment. Now, there's two separate, or I'll say actually three separate arguments that Mr. Apple and interveners made in their brief. One had to do with the personal jurisdiction, the second had to do with subject matter jurisdiction generally, and the third was due process. I'll just start with the personal jurisdiction issue. Here, it's not a consideration of whether there's personal jurisdiction in the forum. It was just an issue of whether process had to be served on who are now the interveners to bring them into this lawsuit. The Rule 103 actually provides different mechanisms for doing that. One is the one that was applied here, which is Section 9 of Rule 103, intervention to claim an interest in the subject property. Let me respond for a moment on the issue of how broad the intervention was. The intervention was, I don't recall the language of it, but it was intervening with respect to the traverses, which including claiming an interest in that property that the garnishees had control over. The second mechanism is Section 11, which could have applied here. It did not. That's where the garnishees, in this case the banks, could have indicated in their answers to the writs of garnishment that these third parties had an interest in the funds that were subject to garnishment. And in that case, the court would have had to have served process on those parties, and then they could, I guess, make their claims in that regard. Either way, unless the who are now the interveners here had been brought into this action, there is no way that the court could have resolved their claims to ownership of the property. In fact, there's a case we cited in our briefs, El Paso County Bank, where this court held just that, where a party did not in that case, the party had tried to intervene. The trial court had denied it because it was too late when they brought a subsequent proceeding. This case held on appeal that their rights had not been extinguished by that first action. So there's three ways it could have happened here. In this case, once they intervened, they were subject to the personal jurisdiction of the court. Let me skip down for a moment to the due process. That's why there's no issue here, because the rule provides for different ways for a party to become, for a third party to bring their interests into the proceeding and to get to argue those. Here, of course, they fully participated in the proceedings. There's been no argument at all on appeal that there's some right that they lost by virtue of how they got involved in the proceeding. And what distinguishes this case in particular from the Pennsylvania cases and some of the other cases that interveners cited in their briefs is the very issue that the way the rule works is that the funds are subject to the jurisdiction of the court through the service of the writ of garnishment on the garnishees and the judgment debtor. That's Section 2C and 2E of Rule 103. But there's no order requiring the funds to be taken from the garnishee and either given to the sheriff or deposited with the court or whatever until the court rules on any objections, which could come from the judgment debtor, interveners, the garnishees, or whoever. There's just different sections of the rules of the rule that pertain however those objections.
Counsel, so is it your position then that the fact that the different banks that were brought into this did not deposit the funds doesn't in some way give the interveners greater rights or different rights vis-a-vis those disputed funds?
I don't think it makes any difference at all. The matter is really whether, and this is sort of a segue to the subject matter jurisdiction issue, the court had jurisdiction over the funds by virtue of the writs. And this is actually, I'll quote just briefly from the rule. This is Rule 103, Section 3, when the writ is, or basically the writ makes the funds, quote, subject to the process of garnishment. And then Section E says, service of the writ gives the court, on the garnishee, gives the court jurisdiction over those funds. So those funds were already, they weren't in the court's registry, but it doesn't make a difference where the funds are being held. In this case, I would say actually that the facts are better than in Great Neck, because in Great Neck, the third party lost control of those funds when the bank deposited them with the court. And I guess that wasn't an issue there. Conceivably, they could have filed a motion for release of the funds or whatever until the objections were ruled on. But either way, here, once the writs were served, those funds were subject to the jurisdiction of the court. And then, of course, by their intervention, they were able to lodge their objections to you know, why they claimed that those funds were actually theirs. And going to the point of intervention, the Great Neck Court actually said, I mean, it was almost exactly the same identical circumstances where a judgment had been domesticated and then the writs were served on the banks. The same two theories were litigated here. The court found that the funds were properly garnished as the property of the judgment debtor. And then the court said, you construe the intervention broadly. Their intervention there, as here, was to claim ownership in the property. And the court said, these theories of fraudulent transfer and alter ego directly relate to that. So you can litigate those in this proceeding. Backing up just a moment on the issue of kind of what theory the trial court applied here. Rule 103, Section 8B3 has two different sections. One has to do with the court finding the garnishee liable to the judgment debtor, and the second has to do with the court finding the garnishee in possession or control of the personal property of the judgment debtor. Now here on, it's pages 11 and 12 of the order, which is 22, 27, and 28 of the record, the court, this is part of the court's findings and conclusions. The court doesn't make the specific finding here, these funds are, you know, doesn't use that magic language to say these funds are funds of Greinberg, but does in, on those pages lay out what the factual, excuse me, what the legal, the relevant legal analysis is here, and says just that, basically, that, let me get to those pages here for a moment. Rule 103 provides a means by which a judgment creditor may reach a debtor's assets, under the control of third parties. That's what theory we were litigating here. That's certainly the theory that Great Neck used in finding or in concluding that it's perfectly fine to litigate these theories in a garnishment proceeding. And then I guess another response to that same issue is that the remedies that are provided under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act include avoiding the transfer, and if you're entitled to avoid the transfer, you can obtain a judgment for the value of the assets. These are CRS sections 38.8, 108.1A, and 109.2, and by virtue of applying those here, there was no duty to trace the funds, or, you know, all these findings are kind of immaterial, because once we proved that these were fraudulent transfers, it didn't matter. The money was fungible. It didn't matter what money was. What we were able to obtain a judgment for that same value. I think I've covered my points here, unless the judges have
just one questions. Last one. I take it that the whole issue of the court attaching more than the judgment is now moot.
Is that fair? It most, I would say, it's harmless error, because this court could just remand and say, well, just make sure you don't deposit more than what's available. But the point is that the rule provides, as we've cited in our briefs, a mechanism where if there are additional funds that are deposited into the court's registry, the excess gets refunded. But at any rate here, when the trial court granted granted the motion to stay, it basically released all of the garnishments, and you know, that's why those funds actually were never deposited with the court.
So I want to make sure I understand this this stay. Your clients have therefore essentially agreed that whatever collection they may be entitled to is coming out of the funds that were deposited into the court.
That's correct.
And that's it, isn't it?
That. For this particular judgment, yes.
For this particular
An attorney fee judgment that's following it.
Yeah, well.
But for this one, yes. Of course, we contested how much the bond should be worth. But, I mean, that's the way it works. We're stuck with what was deposited. But it was 125% of the amount of this judgment. So it should cover that. And once that happened and the garnishments, you know, the order itself was released, it didn't really matter where the money was coming from. That bond is sitting in the court's registry. So here, just as the court had personal and subject matter jurisdiction under the facts in Great Neck, so too did the trial court have jurisdiction below. Interveners intervened in the Rule 103 proceedings, and they had ample opportunity to obtain discovery, to file pleadings, and to present evidence The court weighed that evidence. It found that Greinberg was not credible. It found that he had the money to pay the judgment, but that he refused to pay it and had used the interveners, which are his wife and the entities that he controls, in order to hide his money. Those facts are all supported by the record, and so we ask the court to affirm the trial court's order and award fees for this appeal.
Ms. Gomez, since you have a few seconds, I'm curious about your thoughts on Mr. Apple's view of what alter ego means. First, as to, and you can answer these in any order you wish, first as to whether you agree with his view, and second, does it matter to your argument whether you agree with his view of what alter ego means?
I don't believe it matters in the first instance, but second, I don't agree. The point of alter ego, and I was looking at the trial court's order, it probably cited some good cases to this effect. First of all, since they haven't challenged the sufficiency of the evidence on those findings, we kind of took it for granted they weren't challenging the findings that those two entities, GPC and CCG, were Greinberg's alter egos. But my understanding as a legal matter of how that works is you disregard the corporate formalities. So it seems to me once you disregard them, they do become one and the same. So I don't think it's pertinent here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Brief rebuttal.
Briefly, Your Honors. First, I want to cover three issues very quickly. First, counsel said in argument that, and Your Honors asked questions about whether this was a proceeding in an effort to reach Mr. Greinberg's assets. And what I want to commend to you and ask that you read very carefully is the traverses themselves, the documents that challenge all this and that started this procedure. And I'm looking at, there were five of them, but I think they were pretty much identical. What counsel said in the traverses was the court should order that money held, and this was relating to Mrs. Greinberg, by Mrs. Greinberg at the bank, be garnished and applied to the judgment because Mrs. Greinberg received asset fraudulently conveyed from Greinberg and or GPC. So the whole point of the traverse was that Mrs. Greinberg's assets should be applied to the judgment, not that the assets were really Mr. Greinberg's. The other thing that may be a misapprehension that Your Honors are under is that avoiding a fraudulent transfer does not mean that the assets were the assets of the transferor. The courts in Colorado have been very clear that fraudulent transfers are voidable. They are not void. That distinction is really important because it doesn't mean that it's not like a theft where the asset remains the asset of whoever was stolen from. It's a transfer is perfectly okay until it's avoided. And so it's the courts have held that the transfers are voidable, not void. So the asset in the hands of Mrs. Greinberg was not Mr. Greinberg's asset. It was hers.
But the court voided it.
No. Yes, the court voided it, but
so then it became the asset of Mr. Greinberg.
No. The effect of the avoidance is that Mrs. Greinberg became obligated to repay that debt or that transfer to Mr. Greinberg. That's correct. But that's very important that you realize that, because that it didn't mean that Mrs. Greinberg was obligated. She was not the garnishee, is what I'm trying to say. If she had been garnished, it would be a different issue. Then we'd have the Great Neck situation. But we don't have that situation. Quickly, second point. Counsel said that the funds that were garnished are subject to the jurisdiction of the court. But I want you to pay close attention to the second argument they made in their brief in order to avoid the due process problem, because the statute and the rule do not require notice to the third parties, which creates the due process problem. They argued very specifically that the funds were not tied up. So there were no funds that were attached by the garnishment. And the judgment creditor has conceded that, and they can't argue that both ways.
Counsel, I believe your time is up now. Oh. Over.
This says minute 11.
Yeah, it's confusing.
It starts counting forward. And
yeah. Oh, it did. All right. Yeah. Thank you.
But thank you. I thank both counsel for their fine arguments. The case is now deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.